a Chevron lawyer to prosecute him, and without a jury trial, has sentenced him to 6 months in prison. He's in Danbury right now for his defending the indigenous people.
How do people follow this one? Maybe they want to support him or learn more about it. Or
freedonziger.com, D-O-N-Z-I-G-E-R, freedonziger.com. And there's a story about the sickening lack of media coverage or misinformation from New York Times and others at gregpalast.com.
Great. That's great. Thank you, Greg Palast, gregpalast.com. As always, we appreciate the good work. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio.
Wraps it up for Flashpoint.
You're listening to KBOO Portland.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, board meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The KBOO Board of Directors meets the fourth Monday of the month starting at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm. Arttalk.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome, everybody, to Art Talk Bus Stop. We are in a new location this month. This is for our May 2022 episode. We're doing a special episode at McDaniel High School, so we have a few new participating students, as well as our usual co-hosting setup with me. I'm Erica Thomas, and I'm here with...
Nicole Cabrera.
Hi, Nicole.
Hi.
And then we'll introduce the McDaniel High School students one by one.
Okay.
So we'll start with Odessa.
Oh, hi, I'm Odessa Berry.
Hi, I'm Kaden Gordon.
Hi, I'm Max Peters.
And this month we're welcoming artist Roger Pete. Welcome, Roger. Thanks for being here.
Hello.
Why don't you tell the students a little bit about who you are and what you do?
Sure. I am an artist living in Portland. Mostly I work in printmaking, various kinds of printmaking, like a lot of screen printing and relief printmaking. And then I also paint murals for a living, and I write things, and I do occasionally some illustration digitally and non-digitally.
Well, you guys prepared some questions last week already, so I'll let you just jump in, whoever wants to start.
How do you make a living doing, like, anything you do?
It's a good question. I have what is referred to as, like, multiple revenue streams. So I make money from, a variety of different directions. Like, one sort of more, you know, coherent way that I make money is that I'm a contractor for this large conservation organization called the Center for Biological Diversity, and I coordinate this project for them called the Endangered Species Mural Project, which means that I plan and paint murals about endangered species in different cities and towns around the country. And that's like a kind of a regular gig. I feel very fortunate to have this, you know, this job. Because they give me kind of carte blanche to just make murals happen, guy. Just go out there and, you know, make them happen. So I search for, you know, walls to paint things on, and then, you know, work with communities to design and implement them, and then paint them. And that's something I've been doing for about 6 years now. And it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty reliable, like, it's not really a job, but it kind of is in the realm of actually being a job. And it kind of went away during the pandemic, so I had to focus a lot more on other things that I do for a living, which is that I make, you know, print objects, and I try to sell them either online or at, like, art shows, you know, or at art fairs or that sort of thing. And in that realm, you know, I'm a member of this cooperative of artists called Just Seeds, and we're a group of mostly printmakers, but people who do printmaking among other things as well. And we're kind of all over North America, mostly in the US, but a couple in Canada and a couple in Mexico. And we have, like, we're a cooperative, so we're all kind of doing various tasks to help the business of selling each other's art, you know, work better. We have a centralized office in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, which is like the mail order app, you know, site. And if you go to our website and buy something off of it, it gets mailed out from there. But we're all producing our own work, and, like, basically if we want to sell it through Just Seeds, we mail it into that Pittsburgh warehouse, and then it gets promoted through our various, you know, our social media networks and our email list and things like that. And we're all also just sort of promoting each other's work in our various contexts, because we're in different cities and we work in just like a different environments and different communities. And I occasionally also get, like, you know, random illustration gigs. Well, somebody will be like, hey, you want to, you know, draw me a logo, or you want to design an editorial cartoon for this newspaper, or can we use one of your images as, like, the back cover of our magazine, that sort of thing. And I don't really pursue those things very much, but they just kind of appear. Sometimes they appear, a lot of them appear, sometimes not very many of them. So.
Thank you.
Yeah. Sure. That's really interesting. So out of the 6 years that you've been doing your work, what do you feel is the most like important like piece that you've done?
Well, for the 6 years, it's just the mural project thing. Like I've been, you know, kind of making art for a living since about 2007. That's when the artist cooperative started. But I mean, as far as like the mural project goes, they have like varying degrees of success, I feel. Sometimes, like, you know, the criteria that I use to sort of assess them is like whether or not they like, you know, they worked well or not, is the degree to which they were integrated into the communities in which I was painting them. So probably one of the best ones in that particular realm of work was this mural we painted in Silver City, New Mexico. And it was working with this youth mural organization that they have in Silver City, that every summer there's like the students at like local schools all collaborate to design and paint a mural somewhere in the town or in the area. So it was integrating this endangered species mural project with this already existing youth mural project, and the students got to pick the subjects and they got to design the mural, and I just kind of facilitated the technical aspects of it. And then the students also helped to paint the mural as well, which is a little bit nerve-wracking because it was a bunch of like, you know, kind of small kids all up on the scaffolding. And I was like, is the insurance okay with this? And like, they're like, no problem, it's fine. So but it worked out great, you know, and that was I feel like that was a really successful one because it actually got a lot of, you know, young people invested in the process, learning about the subject matter and actually getting to create the thing that we were installing as well, so.
This is kind of similar to that question, but where do you get your inspiration for the pieces that you make?
Lots of different places. I mean, I think like the sort of the thing I always sort of default to in terms of, you know, trying to come up with some kind of idea for a new thing is thinking about, you know, the quote unquote natural world, right? So like the world of everything that's not specifically human, all of the different organisms that surround us, you know, on the planet, to varying degrees day by day, and the lives they lead and the things that they go through in order to thrive or perish. And I try to, you know, learn about, you know, as much about like this subject, which is a, you know, an enormous, immense subject, and try to, you know, think about ways to extract, you know, maybe not lessons, but just information or ideas or interesting stories from the, you know, the stuff I learn about the natural world that can be applied to the sort of social context, the issues that we all deal with every day as we're trying to navigate the world we live in and maybe try to make it better. So that's like usually where I start. You know, if I'm like, well, what, I need to make some art, where am I going to start? That's kind of where I default to.
For your art, how do you think it makes a change relating to like climate change or like endangered species? How does art make that change?
That's a good question. I think that I think about this a lot. Because a lot of times it can seem like, you know, you're just kind of yelling into the wind and nothing is really producing any kind of effect. But one thing I've come to realize over the years of, you know, trying to make art that communicates ideas to people, that is trying to, you know, relate to, you know, the things that people are already doing or what I think it would be, you know, great if people did, I find that things work a lot better when they are trying to, instead of trying to persuade people of things, they are trying to function as sources of collective validation for things that people already believe. So there are things that people can look at and realize that there are people out there with shared beliefs, shared interests, shared sort of senses of what is a good idea and what is a bad idea. And that can function to help people feel less, you know, less hopeless and less alone in whatever it is that they're doing to try to, you know, change the world in their own way, in their own town, in their own context, however that works. But that's the thing that I feel is like most useful about what I do, rather than just like, you know, spending a lot of time describing exactly what I think is a good idea, because maybe that doesn't work for everybody. Just trying to show, you know, to create points of identification for people who are in, you know, who might be like on the edge of a movement, wondering whether or not they should get into it, and making it feel like it's something appealing, it's something welcoming, and it's something that they feel like is going to actually do something useful in the world.
Go ahead.
Like, what first interested you in making the art that you make now?
I got into printmaking because I really liked the way you could just like make stuff repeat. You could make multiple copies of things. You know, I started, like way back in the day, whatever art I started making, I was making like, you know, flyers for events or for bands or for political actions or, you know, like political or environmental organizing, you know, something like announcing events. So they design something and like, you know, take it to Kinko's, FedEx, and photocopy it, put it up around town. And then I got into the idea of like, you know, maybe making these things more elaborate, more enticing, more exciting for people to look at, maybe it will make more people come. So I started, you know, looking into and getting into like different ways of reproducing images and making images, you know, where I didn't have to go, you know, to Kinko's and like use a copy machine, where I could just do it all myself, and I could design increasingly more elaborate images to go with whatever, you know, call to action I was trying to create. And so, you know, that was the beginning of the process. And like following that path down, you know, down towards like getting more technically involved in different techniques, learning how to do things better, sort of challenging myself to create, imaginative utilizations of different kinds of printmaking techniques. And then from there, just, you know, taking it into realms where instead of it just being something you're just putting on a lamppost to try to get somebody to come to an event, it's an idea that is just that extends from there into, you know, the rest of everyday life, where you're just trying to like explore different ways to communicate ideas and get people to relate to them.
Nice. I'm going to pop in with a question, which is that being familiar with your work, I'm curious if you would be willing to talk a little bit about what your art looked like before you made a living from it.
Sure. It didn't really look that different. I mean, it was a lot. That was like a long time ago. I feel like I have improved. So maybe it was just not saying that my art is like particularly good now, but it was definitely not anywhere near as good, whatever you want to call that, as before. It was, simpler. Maybe it was a little bit more sort of strident. You know, something that I really enjoy is I enjoy making images that are, you know, are clear and are, you know, like that like convey a point directly, but I also enjoy making images that are like a little confusing, because, you know, kind of, which is, I come to that, you know, after thinking about, you know, like the way that like advertising will sometimes, you know, people who are like advertising something will sometimes like misspell a word or just like make something wrong in the advertisement, so that when you look at it, your brain is like, hold on, that's not right. And so you keep looking at the advertisement because it's like, oh wait, that's not right. You know, and it's a way of capturing the attention of an audience. So sometimes, you know, I make things that are intentionally, that I like, you know, maybe not, they're not confrontational, but they're challenging in that when you look at them, you don't necessarily get like a flood of endorphins and serotonin and like, yes, here it is, the struggle we're all involved in. But it sort of creates a like a paradox or contradiction that hopefully you look at and you think you take away from it like, oh yeah, this is a lot more difficult than I want it to be, and I actually do have to think about these things a lot more. And like, you know, the goal of trying to do that in a way that is simple is something that I've always tried to do. And I think that before I was making a living at art, I did a lot more of that, and that is a thing that, you know, if you're trying to sell objects to people, you know, that is maybe a thing that a lot of people are like, I'm not gonna buy that and hang out on my wall. So I would just put it up in the street, you know. So be like, I'm not trying to sell this to anybody. I'm just gonna like paste it on a wall or like on a lamppost or something. So
I was actually kind of thinking about puppets.
Oh, sure.
I'm asking about that. We don't have to talk about that, but I was just curious that there were other forms before printmaking.
Yeah, I mean, puppets, you know, I was living in Minneapolis in the late 90s, early zeros, and you know, Minneapolis is a big puppet town. There's a lot of different kinds of like puppet theater going on there, from the small to the extremely large. And it has a lengthy tradition of different kinds of puppet theater. Every year they have this amazing sort of ceremony, celebration, parade. It's called the May Day Parade, where all these different groups and theaters build these enormous puppets, and local weirdos come out, and it's just like this massive, crazy parade that goes through the center of the south side of the city to this park, where there's this big ceremony that happens around this lake involving these enormous puppets. And it's, you know, it's something that like it creates a real sense of community, a sense of shared identity, a sense of like transformation of the seasons from winter to spring, because winter is so terrible in Minneapolis. And then you transition through this sort of ceremonial experience into springtime. And it's a very powerful event. And, you know, I used to do stuff for that, and I did stuff for other like puppet things. And that was a way of, you know, like telling stories, getting into, you know, talking about ideas and coming up with narratives and, you know, exploring different ways of communicating things in a more expanded format, but also in a way where you have, you know, you have a degree of control over the performance that is different than if you are like, you know, doing an ordinary theater show where it's just people who are talking to each other, you know, and like narrating lines to each other. In puppetry, you can do a lot more, you know, weird and strange stuff. You can have characters that you couldn't really have in the real world. You can play with simplifying things or play with, you know, with making things more complicated. And you can play with like, you know, visual tricks, sound effects. And I got really into that for a long time. But it's one of those things that you have to constantly build an audience for. And I was also living in the middle of nowhere at the end period of the time when I was involved in that, so I stopped trying to build an audience.
How would you consider your art unique compared to other climate-like artists?
Well, I don't know. I guess if I had to say there's one thing that I feel like I'm trying to do with some climate-related art that I feel like I would like more people to do is sometimes I try to use humor to talk about, you know, climate issues, because it can be very overwhelming and unpleasant and horrifying to consider, you know, the sort of worst-case scenarios of the contemporary climate situation. And you spend too much time thinking about that things that way, and you just want to throw in the towel, and you're like, I don't want to try and do anything, because what's the point? So, you know, in incorporating a little bit of humor, you know, maybe not too much, but a little bit of something that can give like somebody just a little bit of a jolt, of a chuckle, in the context of considering, you know, the difficulty of the situation that we all face, that is something that I feel like we could use more of. You know, because you don't want to make it frivolous, but you do want to make it a little less than just total disaster all the time. And a way of, you know, giving people a little bit of relief while they're thinking about serious things, I think, is an important tactic if you're trying to communicate ideas to people. So I don't know if I'm definitely not the only person that does that, but I wish that more people did it or thought about it, you know, the possibility of it.
What things motivate you to do the kind of art that you do? Because it can probably be a little sad at sometimes, because you focus on some serious topics like climate change. So what motivates you to do that kind of art?
I work a lot on climate stuff, and I also work a lot on just the issue of, you know, biodiversity in general, and, you know, the contemporary, because I feel like there's two big crises that we're experiencing in the world right now. One is climate, you know, spinning out of control, and one is biodiversity collapsing, and those things are linked. And I feel like, to some degree, in our popular discussion of things, climate gets a lot of focus, it gets a lot more focus than the sort of collapse of biodiversity does. And one of the things that I feel like I try to focus on both, but I try to maintain like a real focus on what it is that we stand to lose if we continue to sort of hemorrhage species and, you know, the populations of plants and animals and fungi and insects and whatever that surround us on the planet, and that we share the space from, and that we have opportunities to learn from. You know, like the entire history of humanity is the history of humans learning from their environment, from everything that's in it. So if there's less of stuff in it, then you have less to learn from, and you have less to formulate a way of living in the world from. So I find that, like, one of the things that I may be drifting away from the point of the question here. sorry. but I'll just forge ahead, because I feel like I'm kind of making a general point that I think does address the question, is that one of the things that that we face in the future is just a very lonely world. You know, we face a lot of like loneliness in the absence of all of the, you know, the species, the animals, the plants, whatever, that, you know, that used to share the space with us. And that, you know, as we consolidate our populations in cities and the, you know, the various industrial processes that capitalism uses to support our lifestyles continue to damage and disintegrate the world outside that context, that we face a massive increase in our personal and collective loneliness and the lack of things to, you know, to mutual, to understand, and to sort of share values with. And I feel like I'm really like veering off into the hinterlands here, but I think that is something that, you know, in terms of like, you know, motivating, like what motivates me, like trying to get back to a sense of fellowship with the world, you know, a sense of like, you know, that we are all here together and we're all responsible for each other, and that we all need, that there is a duty of us all to sort of share the responsibility of care for each other, and that goes for people as well as for the rest of the world. Hopefully that wasn't too incoherent.
I actually had a question I wanted to jump in with. Sure. When looking at, when I was on the, I forgot, was it Your Seeds or The Seeds or the, where it has a lot of your work presented, mm-hmm. You often have like a lot to say about your work in terms of like when I read your blog, and it really makes me wonder, like, what is your background and knowledge, or sort of like, did you go to school and stuff like that? Because I feel like a lot of artists are either like, I have so much to say about my work, or I'm like, these are two circles, this is my work. So I'm just really curious, like, you know, what is your background?
I went to college and I have a degree in sociology. But most of what I think about all the time, and the stuff that, you know, what I draw from to like make the work that I make, is just based on, you know, books that I read and experiences that I have in the world, you know, like traveling, like going to, you know, going backpacking, spending time, you know, in wilderness areas or just in the backcountry, like out, you know, in the, and trying to learn about the things that are there, the things that are around, you know, like noticing insects, noticing different plants, and trying to learn their names, trying to learn their, you know, what it is that they do, how they live their lives, and how that like relates to me. And you know, I always had, you know, kind of like an interest in, you know, in the natural world. And you know, when I was a kid, you know, I lived in a lot of different places all around the world. And then when I was very young, I lived in like Saudi Arabia, and I would go snorkeling all the time. And so for a very young age, I was just aware of this like profusion of, you know, beautiful, complicated and weird environments underwater. And I think that was like maybe the first thing that it, like that sort of started the engine of my like interest in the natural world. But I also, I lived for like 5 years in this cabin that I built myself in the forest in Southern Oregon, in the sort of like intentional community with a bunch of other, you know, weirdos. And it was like way out there, and like we had very little infrastructure, and we kind of built all the structures on the land ourselves. And it was a real like immersion in just like having, you know, like very minimal like human infrastructure around, and just being like it, like living in the forest. And during that period of time, I just like my awareness of all the different stuff that was going on around me at all times like increased exponentially. You know, it was just like I would be sitting at my desk in this cabin that I built, and this like a family of, you know, juvenile possums would like go past the door, and they're all like, and juvenile possums are like really hilarious, weird creatures because they're just like hissing like snakes all the time, and they're very cute, and they're just like and it's just, you know, this thing is scampering past, or like every, you know, as I would be like working on artwork at my desk, this wasps that lived in this nest in the ceiling would like, these mud dauber wasps would like just kind of come down past my ear and go out through this hole in the window, and I would just be there like writing or drawing or whatever, and then be like hum and then go out, and then later in the day they would come back in and be hum and go back to the nest. And so it was this context in which I really felt like I was submerged in the world in a way that I hadn't been for most of my life, you know, living in the city. And that, I feel like that experience really transformed a lot of like, you know, what I valued and what I thought, how I wanted to like, you know, live my life, and what I wanted to do with whatever work I was creating, whatever ideas I was trying to express.
Do you still live in the forest? If not, why did you like leave?
I don't anymore, but the little house that I built is still there. I don't anymore because it's, you know, it's kind of difficult to sustain that kind of existence in the modern world. You know, it was, you know, we had no internet, we had only a landline, we had very little electric power, no running water, you know. And so a lot of stuff that I wanted to do, I was like, I can't do it because we don't have any infrastructure. And those things, you know, things like that, where like people start them in a period of like excited ideological idealism when they're younger, and then certain things, their lives change, maybe they have a kid, maybe they, you know, they have other things come up in their life, and they need to make more money because, like, living rurally in extremely rural Southern Oregon, the economy is basically zero. So I would have to just go elsewhere to work and come back, and that was the only way I could like make a living. And it just, you know, those things over time, people's changing lives and changing experiences led to them moving on towards other things, and eventually, you know, just population collapse didn't really work anymore. So I moved to Portland, and you know, I still had that little space there, but I try to maintain the connection to the ideas that I formed in that time of my life. But now I have access to a lot more infrastructure that I am able to, like, you know, work on my ideas in a lot more elaborate ways, which is also, you know, it's a trade-off, you know, like everything.
Great questions, you guys. Yeah.
Earlier when you were talking about being like submerged in your art and the environment, you mentioned writing. Are you interested in writing as well?
Yeah, I love writing, you know. I wrote a book recently. which was a very satisfying experience because I kind of wrote it just it was like during the pandemic, like I wrote this book, and with no expectations of what was going to happen to it. Like I didn't have anywhere, you know, anybody thinking that I was, that they were like, they weren't like, hey, where's the book, man? You know, we need the book. So I was just free during the weird time distortion field of the pandemic to just write whatever it was that I wanted. And I had this very specific story that I wanted to tell about, you know, my life, my family, and certain ways in which my family history, which is very strange, interacted with the history of the world in the 20th century. And then, so I wrote this book, and it's, you know, it's finished now, and I'm trying to find a place for it to go, you know, trying to find a publisher, and that's moving slowly, but I have confidence that eventually it will go somewhere. But I also like to write, you know, like I don't, if you've looked at the blog that I have, I for a long time now I've been the basically like the social media manager of that artist cooperative. So I'm always sort of composing the language that is how the cooperative is represented to the world, and like representing like the work and the ideas of individual people who are part of it and the group as a whole. And, you know, and that is something that I've really enjoyed doing over a long time, because it is, you know, it's like thinking about other people's ideas and how you think they might want to represent them, and how to knit that into this sort of like more global sense of a group of people who don't necessarily all agree politically, but are kind of all in the same, you know, quadrant, you know, for want of a better concept of like the, you know, the economic authoritarian, like libertarian quadrant system. I don't know if you've seen that diagram. Anyway, but think about ways to talk about that to an audience that is going to make it seem interesting and engaging and exciting to an audience, and to express people's values and ideas. So that's been a really interesting thing that I've done a lot of. And also I just, I try to write about, you know, just, you know, political and environmental ideas that I think about, things that I think about, things that I find interesting for the blog on that site. And I've done, you know, I should do more of that, but you know, it's a blog is kind of a, you know, it's halfway between a magazine article and a Twitter post. You know, where it's like you want it to be short enough that people are going to probably make it all the way through, but not so short that it's just like, you know, it's just like, it's just too brief to include a lot of interesting ideas.
Do you want to talk any about some of the books that you've made, not necessarily like as writing pieces, but artist books?
Sure.
That's a form that we haven't talked about yet.
Yeah. I mean, I have. Over the years, I have coordinated the production of these like groups of screen printed or printed objects as portfolios. So it's like working with a bunch of different artists who all are creating an image based on a particular theme, a bit of different like political idea, and then producing those things and then packaging them together as a big group of prints that are all different individuals or groups' ways of interpreting a political idea. And we did one that was all about frontline climate change groups. So like each artist like portrayed the work and the ideas of a different climate organization. And we did one about like issues of migration and the militarization of the US-Mexico border. So it was like a bunch of different artists all working on their own ideas related to those subjects. And you know, each of those things gets like kind of like packaged into a box, and sort of it functions as an easily distributable exhibit. So you can get one of these copies, you can put it up, and you have an art exhibit about this particular subject, and it's all there, and you can have events and have people come and talk about it, you know, in the context of like maybe like some organization is doing some work and wants to have a fundraiser, and they can have these things there in the background for people to look at and talk about. So that's something that I've done a couple times, and I'm working on another one of those right now. But I've also done I started working with this art book distributor in New York called Booklyn, and one of the people involved in that asked me if I wanted to make an art book that was just like just something that I made. So I used this is also something that I did during the pandemic because a lot of free time to work on like, you know, more expansive projects. And I produced this book of like lino cut prints on this letterpress that I have. Maybe I'll show it to you in a minute. But it was called Seven Elemental Forces, and it was these seven images of different forces that we are going to have to interact with and deal with on a more regular basis as a result of climate change. And it was sort of presented as a like a field guide. You're like, here's these things that you're going to have to deal with a lot more in the future. And I paired each one with a quote from somebody, either like a scientist or a politician or a regular person who had been quoted in the context of having to deal with these elemental forces in their life. Like, and there are things like fire and flood and disease and drought and things like that. And that was a really fun thing to produce and make this kind of elaborate hand. I printed it all on individual sheets of paper and then glued them all together to make this book that you can read through like a book. And then Erica and I did a cool book project while we were at a residency recently in Tanzania, where we made this book that was the result of our conversations with the people who were basically the audience and community around this art space in the city of Dar es Salaam. And we asked people questions about climate change and had conversations about the ways that that is manifesting in their environment and incorporated those conversations and the ideas that we got out of them into the production of this artist book thing that was really fun and elaborate thing to create. Actually, I have it here.
Oh, great. Do you guys know what a lino cut is? That he used that word lino cut, and I was thinking maybe that is a term. I was thinking maybe we could kind of venture into like how it's made.
Sure.
The kind of like actual nuts and bolts of how printmaking works and the different kinds of printmaking. Would that be interesting for you guys to hear a little about?
Yeah.
Okay.
Let me see if I can pick this stuff up. And let's see here. Let's see, a dramatic reveal. This is my press here. I'm speaking into the microphone, and then I'll put the microphone here. So this is the printing press. So here, this is a block that I was printing yesterday. So this is a piece of linoleum, right? Just like linoleum flooring, but this is slightly fancier for artist use. So you can see that I've carved this image into the surface of it. And what I do with this is that you put ink on the surface and then you press paper onto the ink and then you get a print, right? So let me go and grab the prints that I actually made out of this. Right, so this I made yesterday. This is the impression that comes off of that block, right? So you can see, so this is the block. And this is the impression. So you can do this, you know, in like things that are just like one color like this. And this is just a very kind of a simple design. It's like I carved this image of these three jellyfish into this linoleum and then printed it on the press. You can also do it like, here's another example of a linoleum block print that is similar thing, but this is two colors. So you can see that there's a yellow block and a blue block, and I've printed one on top of the other. This is actually one of the best copies of this print. Right, so that's how I do things here in my home studio, because I have this press thing to work on. So I have this big stack here of all these different blocks that are the things that I use to print different stuff. And they're all just like different carvings
that I use to make these different kinds of prints. And the press thing, let's see if you can see it there. So it's this, yeah, it's a nice, really nice old machine from the 20s. And you put ink on here, and you turn this little handle, and it puts the ink through the system, and then you roll this thing, you roll this thing back and forth, and that applies the paper to the inked block. So that is one way that I make things like that. Another way is through screen printing. And pull out here. All right, so this is an example of a screen print that I just made. And this, so this image is, do you know what, you all know what screen printing is and how that works? Sort of.
Yeah, kind
so
of.
It's like,
kind of. Maybe some explanation is good.
Basically, like, you know, if you have a, like a t-shirt, you know, with a design on it, usually that design is getting on there by screen printing. And screen printing is, you're using a squeegee to push the
Wait,
through the...
can you go back to the beginning? We couldn't hear what you were saying.
Oh, sorry. Silk screen printing is like applying, pushing ink through a stencil that is on a polyester mesh that is held in an aluminum frame onto a substrate. And either that's paper, or maybe it's a t-shirt, or whatever else. You know, it's like, it's how most t-shirts or sweatshirts or things like that, or hats, if you have just like, if it looks like it's just a single layer of ink, it's probably been put there by screen printing. So this image here is made with like three layers of screen printing. So there's like a red layer, that's what's like the first layer, and then on top of the red layer is the yellow layer, and then on top of the red and the yellow is the green layer. So a lot of printmaking works in this way, where you're just building up different layers of stuff to create different effects, different like ways that things look visually. And that's another really fun thing that I enjoy about printmaking, is just building up layers on top of each other. And you know, you make different colors, you make different textures, and it's just it's a very satisfying way to create an image. And the great thing is that you can make multiple copies of it. Like, I just printed like 100 of these things, of this cicada print. You know, it took me a few days, and it was a lot of work, because you're standing at this thing just like pulling and moving the paper, and pulling and moving the paper, and pulling and moving the paper, and you do that all day, and then you start again. But at the end of it, you have a bunch of copies of this, of this sort of like screen printed image. So those are like two ways in which I produce things. Oops, didn't work. Okay, I just gotta stand over here.
Nicole, do you have any questions you want to jump in?
Yeah, so I actually had a question about the screen printing, sort of, I guess, logistically, or like how you think it out, because, you know, in my brain, like, that's not how art like works, where I can like see shapes and then like lay them down on a paper and create something. So I was wondering, like, for you, is that just something you've learned over time, or like, what is the process of sort of like, like, you know, having these colors and creating layers and creating like empty shapes or creating negative space and all that kind of stuff? Like, how does that work for you?
It can be complicated, and it can you have to do a bunch of planning in advance in order to make things turn out the way that you want them to. And sometimes they don't turn out the way you want them to, and sometimes that's okay. And then also sometimes it's not okay, and then you have to pretend that you like it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a, you know, like typically with, you know, like for example with this thing, you know, I just made a drawing of the various shapes of it. I'm like, okay, I'm gonna draw. Like, I drew all basically like all the shapes of the insect, you know, the green layer here, which has all the detail on it. And like, you know, where how everything was sort of oriented. And I drew a picture of that. And then And then I, you know, I drew on that picture all the other elements, like the circular bits and where I wanted all these other things to go. And then I figured out, okay, if I have this layer combined with this layer, it'll make a different color. So, okay, I need to make, you know, how many layers am I going to have total? Okay, I'm going to have three. And this like top drawing is going to be the basis for the under layer. So you start with the one, you go from the level that has the most detail, and you work down from there, basically. It's like, because oftentimes when you're printing, you know, like you think about like a comic book. The way a comic book is printed is that they print the colors first, and the way those colors mix together makes a lot of different colors. And then on top of that, they print the black, right? So that's like the black line drawing that like traps all of the other colors and gives you the clear outline of where everything is, all the different shapes, how the different shapes are oriented. That's basically how it works with the kind of printmaking that I do, is you start with the layer that has the most information on it, which is often called the key block. And then you work down the layers from there to the bottom layer, which you're going to put everything else on top of, which everything else is going to mix with. And then the final layer that sits on top of it is the one that makes everything clear, right? It makes it shows you what all the relationships are with all the other things. Let me see if I have an example of that. Of course, I've spent the last decade trying to not do that. Here's a good example, right? So this is another screen print, right? So this is a combination of a screen print and a block print, right? So the black image here, that's something I made by carving linoleum and then printing it onto tracing paper. And I used that to make the silkscreen. But what I have here is I have these two layers of the purple and the pink. And the purple is the bottom layer, and the pink sits on top of it. But you can see under the black of the snake, there's also pink and purple. And they're doing this work to like show the shadow on the snake or the light on the snake. And then, so you've got all this like information in there. And then when you put this black layer on top of it, it traps these other layers and forces them to make your eyes think that like, ah, there's a shadow here, right? That's the shadow of the snake. Oh, this is where the light is shining on the snake. So it's just kind of thinking about, there's a lot of thinking about where light is shining, you know, like your fictional light, like where is it coming from and how is it altering the thing it's touching?
How did you get into like screen printing or printing in like general?
It's mostly just because I wanted to be able to make multiple copies of things. Because there's, you know, the big difference between like if you're trying to make art for a living in terms of like you're trying to sell things, you know, to people for a living. You know, you can kind of basically follow two basic paths. You know, this is a gross oversimplification, but bear with me. You know, you can have a painting. You do like an oil painting, an acrylic painting. It's big, it's beautiful, it's got a lot of stuff going on in it. And you're like, okay, I've got one painting, and I'm going to sell it for $1,000 to one person. And that's how I'm going to make $1,000. Or you can have, you know, a print that you make 100 copies of, right? And you're like, okay, I have this print and I'm gonna sell 100 copies of it to 100 people and each one is $10. And so then 100 people have that print, right? And if that print contains some kind of idea that you're trying to convey, you're trying to like promote some kind of message or convey something that you think is interesting, or like I said before, how, you know, make some kind of simple symbol of like political identification that people can relate to, then that thing that you've made, if you make a print, that goes out to 100 people and they all have it in their homes and they live with it, they look at it and they think about it, and that's with them every day, and they only had to pay $10 for it. And the painting, you know, maybe it's just in one person's house, maybe it's in a museum, maybe, like, you know, it's in storage somewhere, nobody ever gets to look at it. So whatever idea you put in it, you know, it has a very limited public life. So the thing that I really enjoy about printmaking is because I am always, like, not always, but most of the time, I'm trying to, like, communicate something. And, you know, that's just how I work. It's what I'm interested in doing. And sometimes that thing is more obvious, sometimes it's less obvious. But I like the idea of having, you know, being able to have this idea go into the houses or in the hands of many more people than just one, right? So that's the thing that printmaking allows me to do.
We have a couple more minutes left. If any McDaniel students have final urgent questions.
So pretty much, what advice would you give to any sort of high school student, anybody who wants to learn printmaking or just sort of is inspired by kind of the stuff that you do? What advice would you give to them in their future, in their career? Or, yeah.
Sure. With printmaking, you know, like, silkscreen printing requires a little bit of infrastructure that can be, you know, a little difficult to set up and cost a little bit of money to get going. But block printing is something you can do with almost, like, no money. You can get started block printing, just making prints for your, you know, if you just want to practice the idea of printmaking. All you need is, like, a piece of linoleum, some carving tools, right? I have these, you know, carving tools like this, you know, which I use to, like, carve into the surface, or things like this. So these are better examples. They're much smaller, you know, making much smaller lines here with this sort of thing. And you can, you know, carve a surface, you can rub the ink on it, you can press the paper on it with a wooden spoon, and you can make a print, and it is easy to do and requires almost no machinery. Like, to get started, you can just get started as simply as possible. One of the things that I like to say about, as you sort of advance up the level of printmaking is to do stuff with friends. Don't try to do everything yourself. You know, you share resources the tools you need to do the things you want to do. If you're working with other people to do that, if you're able to pool your resources to make things possible for a group, it's a lot easier to make something happen than it is if you're just trying to do it by yourself and you only want to do it by yourself and you want to have all your own stuff. It's easier to do it if you share resources, and you can go a lot further if you're collaborating, both on sharing resources and on, like, building whatever it is that you want to build.
Thanks for sharing all of this with us, and thanks for being here, Roger.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
Does anybody else have anything they want to add or before we close out? Roger, do you have anything that you want to promote? Any shows coming up or?
No, not really. no. But thanks very much for having me to talk. That was fun. Good questions.
Thanks for being here.
Yeah.
Okay.
You've been listening to an interview with Portland-based artist Roger Peet. We are Art Talk Bus Stop, a monthly youth-centered podcast about how artists do their work and make a living. I'm the producer, Erica Thomas. You can catch our show on the fourth Wednesday of each month from 11 to noon on KBOO FM. That's KBOO 90.7 FM Portland, and streaming at kboo.fm/program/art-talk-bus-stop. We'll be back in June with a new guest. Sweetest of love, I found out, came upon me, and I was so sweetest of love, guiding us through, came upon me, and I